From WJCT Studios in Jacksonville, Florida, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And this is Deemable Tech, technology worth talking about. We're here to make technology simple, easy, and approachable for you.
Got a question about your computer, smartphone, tablet, or the internet that you want to ask us? Give us a call at 904-372-DEEM. That's 904-372-3336. Or you can send us an email at questions@deemable.com.
And this week we have a special guest, Elizabeth Pampelone. She specializes in small business computer consulting and computer training. And you do some computer repair too, right, Elizabeth?
That's right. You can check out my website, elizabethpampelone.com, for more information.
Excellent. And welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Thank you. It's great to be here. There's so much testosterone in this room. It's going to be an interesting episode.
Well, I mean, all of our episodes are pretty testosterone heavy, but it's nice to have a little estrogen to balance it all out.
Yeah, it smells nice in here this week. Well, if you listen to last week's episode, you know that last week was Pledge Drive Week here at WJCT, so we didn't really have much time in the studio to record an episode.
Yeah, and if you didn't listen to last week's episode, I mean, come on, man. It was only 9 minutes long. Go listen to it.
We asked for so little. Well, whether you did or not, the point is we answered one question last week, right? One whole question. So we have a whole backlog of questions to get to, so we're just going to dive straight into it. So let's get started. First up, we have a voicemail from Joel.
Hi, my name is Joel, and I'm calling from Lawrenceville, Georgia, which is basically Atlanta, Georgia. Long-time listener. I just got myself an iPad 2, and I have never used an Apple product before except for an old iPod. So I've got no familiarity with the software or anything like that, because I've been most familiar with Android and Windows software. I need to find out what type of apps and what type of other software I can install or what you would recommend for me to install on the iPad so that I can get started. And that should do it.
Okay. Advice for an iOS noob. Well, let's see. Now, my first Apple device, my second Apple device was an iPad also.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Actually, it was an iPad 2, technically.
So, what was your first Apple device?
My first one was an iPod Classic from many years ago. But my first iOS device was an iPad 2. So I remember that feeling of opportunity, like you had the whole world at your fingertips at last. Thus began my love of Apple products.
Oh, Lord.
Anyway, let's see. First things first, the very first app you need to get is the podcast app. It's made by Apple. It's not the best podcast catcher out there, but it's free, it's easy to use, and it does the job. And then, of course, once that downloads, what you want to do is go into the app and search for Deemable Tech. That's DEEMABLE Tech. And then click subscribe. That's the most important
part. I think I've heard of that show. That's really good.
Yeah, and that if you do nothing else, that's what you need to do first. So a little bias there. But now, I'm not sure if you bought a new one or if you bought it used, Joel. But if you did buy it used and you're interested in jailbreaking it, don't upgrade to iOS 6 yet. As far as I know, there's no jailbreak tool that's been updated for iOS 6 yet, but I could be wrong on that. I myself am not a jailbreaker. We've talked about that before, but, yes, as a nerd, I should be ashamed of myself, but, you know, this is my iPhone 4S is my daily driver, so I'm not tinkering with it just yet. But once it's out of warranty, which that'll be pretty soon, then I'll start playing with it. But if you are interested in jailbreaking it, go to imore.com. They have all the information you could ever need about jailbreaking. And now, you are an Android user, so here's a couple of apps that you must download right now on your new iPad. Actually, right after you download the podcast app, because, again, that's the most important one. Mm-hmm. Get the Google Drive app and Google Chrome.
Oh, yeah.
We've talked about Google Drive on the show a lot. It's fantastic since they updated it on iOS to where you can actually edit documents.
Yeah.
That's kind of a necessary feature. Editing spreadsheets is still excruciating on Google Drive, but document editing is pretty great for a mobile device. Actually, I wrote up a lot of the notes for this show on Google Drive on my iPhone.
There you go.
Also, Google Chrome is awesome too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, like I've said before on the show, you can't replace Safari as the default browser like you can on Android, but it does have Chrome tabs that can sync with your desktop and your phone. So you can open a site that you had open on one of your other devices and just keep rolling. And of course, all your favorites are synced as well. And have you used the Google Chrome as well, Elizabeth?
Yes, I have actually. And I use it at home on my laptop. And then when I get to work, I can go in, sync the Google Chrome on my desktop at work, and have all my favorites if I need to pay a bill during lunch or something like that. It's really, really handy.
Yeah, it is fantastic. I mean, I use Chrome here at the station, and nobody else uses Chrome. So I just stay logged in on Chrome here. But it's really funny when someone logs in on Chrome and I see what they've been up to.
So, yeah, you want to make sure you log out of that.
Yeah, so, notice somebody was playing Angry Birds on the computer at the station. Now, Joel, you are probably a GChat user as well, or Google Chat. So I would grab VTalk. It's VTOK from the App Store. It's a pretty good Google Chat app, and it's free. You can do text, voice chat, and video chat with anybody on Google Chat. And it works. Actually, me and Tom tested it. It worked as good as FaceTime. I mean, It was good quality. If you're a Google Voice app user, definitely check out Talkatone. That's Talkatone. That's a pretty decent Google Voice app that lets you make phone calls over VoIP on your Google Voice account. Again, it's not the greatest app, but it does a job if you want to make phone calls on your iPad. Just make sure that you get a headset. You'll look like an idiot holding your iPad up to your ear at Starbucks. I know this from experience.
That's a great visual,
right? My phone died. I had my iPad. I'll make a phone call. I didn't have my headphone. So I just held it up to my ear like an idiot. So, also, I'm guessing, since you're an Android user, you probably are a Gmail user as well. Now, I would have recommended getting Sparrow, which is a phenomenal Gmail client. It rivals the Gmail experience on Android. But Google recently bought Sparrow, and they have announced that they're not going to be updating the Sparrow app anymore. So hopefully we'll see Sparrow rebranded as the Gmail app, and we'll see that come out free, because the Gmail app is completely atrocious. Don't waste your storage space downloading it. But Sparrow is still great if you want to, you know, drop a couple bucks on it. It's an awesome app. Let's see. And I'll give you a little trick that I figured out about Gmail. It works best if you set it on your iPad twice. Now, that sounds kind of strange, but what you'll do is you'll set it up as a Microsoft Exchange account to sync your contacts and calendar, to sync those, but set it up as a Gmail account for your mail and your notes. If you do it that way, you'll be able to use your Google Contacts, and the native mail app will let you archive emails easier. And your notes will sync on the Notes app too. It'll be synced backed up to your Gmail account. Just Google search Google Sync iPad, and it'll walk you through that. It'll give you a walkthrough that tells you step by step how to set up Google Sync for your calendar and contacts. And then Google search set up Gmail iPad and for a walkthrough to set up your mail and notes. And like I said, it's kind of strange that you have to do them separately, but the end result is definitely worth it. So you just set it up twice.
So Ray, what about native apps? So he's going into the iOS universe. What does he need to check out?
Okay, so yeah, going back to what Apple actually makes. If you play music at all or you want to make videos, GarageBand and iMovie are absolutely awesome. They are well worth the $5 to get them. And you've got some experience using those too, right?
Yes, I do. And actually, one of the really great native apps is the voice memo that you can
voice
create.
Voice memo, yeah, absolutely.
I've actually recorded concerts. I've been at a concert hall and recorded
really?
The music, and
yeah.
It sounds amazing. And I've done a lot of podcasting, even just using the voice memo app and just recording like a lecture or something like that.
Very cool.
So in conjunction with GarageBand, it works awesome.
Yeah, it works great with that. Now, the Pages and Keynote and Numbers, those, you know, of course, are the competitors from Apple for Word, PowerPoint, and Excel. Those are really a hard sell because they're $10 a piece. Numbers is actually really awesome. I use that one a lot. That's the Excel alternative. I never knew how convenient having a really great spreadsheet on a tablet would be until the first time I used it. So it is really phenomenal. I have never used Keynote except for the one time I was making a graphic for a video. So unless you're really PowerPoint crazy and you need it on your iPad, I probably wouldn't bother. I used to use Pages constantly, but I found that since Google Drive came out with editing, I hardly ever use Pages now. So if you need offline editing, then maybe check that out. But if you have kids, get a case for it right now.
Yes.
The thing that our iPad gets used the most for is as a second television set. Mm. Between Netflix, Hulu, HBO Go, PBS, Disney Channel, our iPad probably thinks it is a TV. I say get a case because once you let it go, you'll hardly ever get it back, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But, you know, when used in moderation, it can be a great distraction to let daddy get his work done or let mommy finish the dishes. So, but yeah, you're going to have a lot of fun. Good luck with that.
Yeah. Congratulations on your iPad purchase, Joel.
Yep. All right. Well, let's see. Can we take another quick question before we go to our break?
Oh, yeah. Let me read this one. Whenever my computer has a problem, I ask my nephew for help because he works in IT. Last time he asked me to send him a print screen of the error message I was getting. How do I do that?
Elizabeth, you're pretty good with that. Can you jump on that one?
Yes. Actually, print screen on a PC is very simple. One, on every keyboard, there's a key titled PRTSCN.
PRTSCN.
Yes. It's usually above the insert key or the home key, which is directly above the arrow keys. And it will actually create a print screen, a photograph of your screen. So if you press that button, it looks like nothing happens. But what it actually does is it saves in memory the capture of your screen. And if you want to just take a picture of one window on your screen, you can hold the Alt key and the print screen button, and it'll actually take a picture of just that one window.
Oh, really? I didn't actually know that.
Yep.
The Windows only holds one photograph in memory at a time. So you actually have to put it somewhere. You can paste it into an email. You can paste it into a Word document. Or you can even use something else that you can just basically paste it into to hold it.
Right, mm-hmm. Like Paint.
Exactly. Exactly. So you can also do the same thing on an iPhone where you hold the home button and press the power button once and it takes a screen capture. And then you can, of course, message it or email it or put it on Facebook to show someone.
How do you do it on a Mac?
Mac, it's a little bit different, but it gives you a lot more options. To print a screen on a Mac, you press the command button and you hold the shift key and the number 3. And that'll actually give you the picture on your desktop in a file of a JPEG. If you actually hold the command shift and 4, it'll give you a crosshair and you can select what you want.
Okay, great. Well, we've got to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll have more of your questions. This is Deemable Tech. Welcome back to Deemable Tech. I'm Ray Hollister, joined, of course, by my co-host Tom Braun and our special guest, Elizabeth Pampalone. Let's see, we got another question from Celia. She asks, I've been using Gmail for a very, very long time, and one of the things I like about it is how simple and unintrusive it is. However, recently, Microsoft released the new Outlook.com email client with a lovely Outlook.com domain. I checked out Outlook.com, and I love how it looks with the Metro UI style. Oh, you're not supposed to call it Metro UI anymore.
Yeah, no. Is Celia, does she live in Redmond, Washington? Does it say in the scene?
It is very, very, it's wonderful. Just glowing reviews. So my question is, in regards to features and functions, which is better, Gmail or Outlook? Now, I've never used Outlook.com. Have you tried it out, Elizabeth?
I actually signed up for it, and I did try it out. It's really actually beautiful.
Really?
It really is.
Nice.
Usually a description reserved for Apple products.
And it's actually, I think, going to be a pretty big competitor as far as Apple is concerned in the near future.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Windows 8 even, this is kind of in conjunction with Windows 8, and I think it's It's on the rise.
Yeah, because it has the same user. It looks the same as like Windows 8. It has those tiles and the same feel.
Correct.
Because we're not supposed to call it Metro anymore. They said stop calling it Metro. It's not Metro.
Apparently that was already a thing and they didn't want to get sued.
So it's the Windows 8 user interface now.
Yes, and it's gorgeous. It really is. And I actually was really surprised because most things from Microsoft don't tend to have that cool feel, the cool factor.
They're trying to be cool. Ever since the Xbox came out, it seems like they're trying to...
They're getting there.
Yeah, and they've got dubstep in all their commercials now. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
And that makes everyone cool.
Exactly.
Well, between Outlook and Gmail, most of the things that I'm seeing are, I used to actually recommend Gmail for my business clients.
Sure.
And because they wanted a user-friendly webmail for business. And most of them that you get with a hosting account are horrible interfaces.
Terrible.
So what I did was tell people, okay, use the Google Pop in account settings and you can just bring in your email and send as whoever you want. Well, Outlook does the exact same thing. And it's gorgeous. Not to mention that it gives you free versions of Word, Excel, and PowerPoint on your account. So it's online. You can use it on a tablet. You can use it on PC, a Mac, anywhere.
And those are all web-based, right?
They're all web-based. Okay. Really? And you also get 7 gigs of storage, which they allow you to use for storing documents and photos. So you can also share photos there as well.
That's not too bad.
No, it's not shabby at all.
You can always upgrade, of course. You know, like everybody has an upgrade, you can pay for it. But even the free one is pretty good.
Nice.
Yeah, because Google Drive comes with 5 gigs, right?
I believe
off the top of my head. I think it's 5 gigs.
I don't remember.
So with your Gmail account, you get 5 gigs of storage for your other stuff.
Correct. Okay, seven is, that much better. Plus PowerPoint, Word, and Excel. I mean, like you said, we talked about pages earlier in the episode and numbers and things like that. But when somebody actually really needs that other, document creation for Word and Excel, it's there. And then, of course, like I said, it does kind of have that Windows 8 feel. And if they can keep the bugs down to a minimum, I think they, like I said, they might give Apple a run for their money.
Wow, really? And the presentations in Google Drive are okay. I mean, they're not fantastic.
Well,
I imagine that with it actually being PowerPoint, it's going to be a little bit more compatible.
That was actually the first one I opened when I got my Outlook.com account. And it's actually, I looked at it and I thought, wow, I'm here on my Mac. I'm sitting here. I don't have PowerPoint open, which the Mac PowerPoint that you can purchase as the app is kind of weird looking. But I looked at it, and I mean, it looks exactly like a Microsoft interface. I mean, it's all the toolbars I'm used to and all the templates I'm used to and that kind of thing.
Well, you've convinced me. I think I'm going to have to check them out.
I'm
Outlook.com to check those out.
Yeah.
Let's see. We got another question.
Yeah, let me take that one.
All right.
Heidi writes, "Dear Deemable, something awful just happened to myself and a fellow mom. Some men that appear over 18, a few way over 18, were on our daughter's Facebooks. Our daughters are 13, and some inappropriate conversations occurred with these men. This happened because our daughters, smart as they are, thought these people were safe because friends recommended the friendships. Now, did their friends really pass these guys along themselves, or did the Facebook program do it? That is what we're trying to get to the bottom of right now. For those that know me, the other mom, and our girls, if this can happen to us, this can happen to anybody. We are as strict gets. And just in case you were wondering, no, the girls aren't on Facebook right now, although the profiles still exist. But that brings up another question. How can you find out if your child has multiple Facebooks? The other mom that is going through this with me right now has discovered through her daughter, being honest about it, that she had multiple Facebooks. My daughter continues to maintain that she does not have multiple Facebooks, and the other girls in this said that my daughter is telling the truth. But is there a way for me to be sure? Thank you."
Ooh, well, thanks for your email, Heidi. First of all, I am sorry that you're going through this. Unfortunately, this looks like it's just going to be a normal part of parenting, at least as long as the internet exists. I'd like to say that as younger folks start, having teenagers, it'll get easier. But honestly, by the time my daughter becomes a teenager, I'm sure there'll be some new website or app that kids will be getting into trouble on or getting taken advantage of on. I don't know how bad the language or the content of these conversations were, but obviously if these men cross the line in any way legally, you need to file a report with the police and press charges. That's just, on my soapbox there. And now I'm actually going to get off my soapbox because I'm not going to waste your time giving you a lecture on parenting because honestly, I'm not qualified to. I do have a 6-year-old that acts like a teenager sometimes, but otherwise I have zero qualifications for giving someone advice on how to raise a teenager. However, of course, you know, just some basics. You do want to keep an eye on what your kids are doing online, not only for their safety, but also because until they turn 18, you're probably responsible for whatever they do. You could be held responsible. But as you probably already know, regardless of how strict you are, if they want to do something, kids can and will find a way. So let's focus on what we know best, which is the technical aspect of the problem.
Right.
Now, you mentioned that your daughter told you that her friends recommended these guys to your daughter to be friends with them on Facebook, and you wanted to know if that was true or if it was Facebook actually suggesting them. Well, there are two methods that Facebook uses to kind of introduce you to other people on Facebook. A friend on Facebook can suggest a friend to you by going to your Facebook profile and clicking the menu on the right-hand side of the page that looks like a gear next to the message menu. When they click on that, they get a drop-down that includes an option that says suggest friends. Also, when you first become friends with someone on Facebook, especially someone who's relatively new to Facebook, Facebook will ask you to suggest more friends for that person. So when you click on that suggest friends link, you're taken to a list of your friends and it says, does Sally know any of your friends? Help her find them. And you can scroll through your list of friends and click suggest friends next to the name of any of your friends that you know that Sally knows. Then both Sally and the friend you suggested will get a friend request notification that shows the other person's name, how many mutual friends they have, and suggested by Ray Hollister, or by your name, obviously. At that point, Sally can either select add friend or ignore. Now, I'm sure you've already had this conversation with your daughter, but much like the friend that suggests jumping off the proverbial bridge, just because your friends suggest becoming a friend with someone else on Facebook does not require that you follow their advice. You know, you still have to use your judgment.
Plus, now, I think a girl named Sally is probably from 1953, so...
I know some young Sallys.
Do you?
Yeah.
All right.
Now,
okay.
Speaking about making friends online, though, you know, personally, I've made friends with folks online before I ever met them in person. And Tom, you have too, right?
Yeah, I actually have some really good friends that I met completely online. But this was, of course, when I was an adult.
Right.
And minors really should never friend someone that they don't already know in person.
Right, exactly. I mean, if you're a minor and you're being friended by someone, the answer is no, unless you know them in person.
Absolutely.
Now, the other way that Facebook introduces you to other people is with the people you may know list. Now, this list is completely automated.
Yeah.
It's created by Facebook, by their algorithm, by determining who on Facebook you may know in real life. The most common reason why they think you might know a certain person is because you have mutual friends with that person. The more mutual friends you have, the more likely it is that you know that person. And that's the list. That list is directly below the friend request and friend suggestion list when you click the friends menu on the top right. It used to be on the left, but on mine it's on the right, and you said it, on yours it's still on the left.
Yeah.
Maybe Facebook is trying with that.
But yeah, usually if there's a suggestion and it's because of mutual friends, they will have a place where it'll say mutual friends. You can click on that and see, okay, who
are these. And it shows you. It's not a suggested friend. It's just, you know, you may know this person. Now, as far as whether or not she was suggested to become friends with these guys by one of her friends, or if they were just listed as people you may know, it's hard to say. Unfortunately, Facebook doesn't show the suggestion on either person's timeline.
Mm-hmm.
The person who made the suggestion does get a notification that says, you know, so-and-so friended so-and-so, and you suggested that. But Facebook notifications only last for a few days, so unfortunately there's no real way to prove it one way or the other. But to be clear, Facebook does not pretend to that someone suggested you to be a friend with someone else. They're very clear about the difference. So
yeah,
it may have been that she just misunderstood what it was, but they don't play that game where, oh, so-and-so mm-hmm. suggested you should be friends with them.
Yeah, yeah, Facebook, I will say in their favor, is not intentionally misleading that way.
Yeah.
And you also asked if there's any way to find out if your daughter has multiple Facebook accounts. Unfortunately, there's not a real simple, easier, definite way that you can find that out. You can look through her browser history, and you can look through her cookies, with the browser cookies, which is the little packets of personal data that are stored on the computer. That might give you an indication that she may have a separate account, but that doesn't stop her from setting up a separate account on a different computer, right, like at her school or friend's house. One thing that you can check that might give you an indication is to check the autocomplete on your browser. When you go to Facebook, look and see what usernames automatically fill in. If you see one there that you don't recognize, there might be a separate account that she set up. Another way that you might be able to find out that your daughter has a separate Facebook account is by being logged in on her account or one of her friends' accounts. Unless she's keeping the two accounts completely separate, her accounts will probably have a few mutual friends. And guess what? She may show up in that list of
right.
people you may
people
know.
You may know list.
And then you can have that conversation with her. Yeah, the problem, of course, is that if she's using a fake name, she could be using a picture that isn't her.
Yeah.
But at least that's an option you can look for.
Yeah, so I mean, other than that, you know, you can kind of poke around in the cookies. You can check the history. And like we were saying, you know, check the other or check her main account and you might see it on there.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, you know, there's no real concrete advice. There's no simple, easy way to find out. But hopefully you can use these and they'll help guide you in the right direction.
Yeah. And I mean, it sounds like you've kind of had or your daughter has had a learning experience here. So maybe that will keep her on the straight and narrow.
Yep. And, you know, putting her on lockdown might work. It could cause rebellion.
I actually saw one thing where the parent was punishing the child for misusing Facebook.
Sure.
And they actually had them hold a sign that said, "I will never misuse Facebook again," and post it as their profile picture for 1 month.
Nice.
And of course, there's always the famous the dad who goes out and shoots the laptop, too.
Yes,
he went
exactly.
On the kid went on Facebook, and the daughter went on Facebook and was ranting about how terrible her father was. So he took his pistol out and filmed it all on YouTube and shot the laptop 6 times. Yeah, took care of that problem.
We do not endorse violence against computers here at Deepable Tech.
It was fun to watch, though. All right. So anyways, Joel actually emailed us a second question, which was a really good one. Normally, we don't do 2 in a row from the same listener, but he left us a voicemail. So that, you know, that gets an extra one. He gets an extra one for that. We love voicemails from listeners. They are sweet music to our ears.
Mm-hmm.
So, Joel, since you sent us a voicemail, you get a bonus question answered as well. Let's see. It says, here we go. Hi, Ray et al. I have a question about Facebook two-step verification. I enabled Facebook two-step verification after hearing about it on your show.
Excellent. Yes.
However, I found a problem that is making me consider turning it off again. No, don't do that. Okay. He didn't say that. I said that. unlike Google's two-step verification process, which has you use an app on your phone to generate the codes, Facebook sends you a text message and gives you the option to use the Facebook app to generate codes. The problem with this is that I can't seem to choose only to use the Facebook app to generate the codes and not have Facebook send me text messages. I don't have a text message plan at all. I use Google Voice, which sends me text messaging for free. However, Facebook doesn't allow you to use a Google Voice phone number for your phone. Mm. Therefore, when Facebook sends me a text message, I'm charged for every message I receive. So the question is, can I somehow keep two-step verification turned on but prevent Facebook from sending me the text messages?
Hey, Joel. So, funny story. This is actually my IRL friend, Joel.
IRL?
In real life.
That's bad grammar.
What do you mean?
Okay. If IRL stands for in real life,
right.
You just said, this is actually my in real friend, Joel. You should have said, this is actually my RL friend, Joel. Just like if he was your friend you knew from Second Life, you would say, this is actually my SL friend, Joel. Or if you knew him from World of Warcraft, you would say...
Okay, thanks, yeah. Okay, he's my real-life friend, Joel.
Sorry, I geeked out there a little bit.
Yeah. World of Warcraft, really? Joel not only sent in this question, but he figured out the answer for himself, and it's an interesting answer, and I learned something from it, so I figure he should actually get the credit for this one, especially because I used him as an example last week.
Yeah, you totally outed him as your example, too.
Yeah, whoops. anyway, here's what I learned from Joel about the answer to this question. So if you want to enable Facebook two-step verification without getting text messages from Facebook as well, basically, when you're setting up two-step verification and it asks you what your phone carrier is, you need to select not listed, comma, other.
Oh.
Then it's going to give you the option to activate through text or voicemail, and obviously you should choose voicemail.
Hmm.
Now, the interesting thing is you still need a second-step verification code whenever you log into Facebook from a new computer or device, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the part I did not realize. Usually you get that through a text, but in Joel's case, he's not going to because he doesn't want texts.
Right.
But you don't have to, and I didn't realize this, and Joel discovered this. You can get the verification number right from your Facebook app on your phone.
Hmm.
When you're in the app, click the button on the top left to bring up the main menu and scroll way down. Down near the bottom, there is an option called Code Generator. Clicking it will turn on and enable you to verify your Facebook app through... Excuse me. to enable you to verify through your Facebook app instead of through a text message. And when you think about it, you kind of have to wonder why they bother with text message at all if the app has that capability.
Sure.
So anyways, thanks for the question, Joel, and thanks for the answer, too. We love learning things here on Deemable Tech. And if you've forgotten what two-step verification is, go back and check out episode 10 of our podcast. Two-step verification is a powerful security tool. Facebook makes it really easy to use. And you ought to turn on and try out if you haven't already, and it will just make your Facebook account that much more secure.
Okay, excellent. I think we got another time for another question real quick. Annie asks, I've been using Dropbox for a good amount of time, and I'm very happy with the desktop client, the web client, and the Android client. However, I've also been using Google Drive for a while for separate documents. I use the web client and the Android client, but not the desktop client. Well, now I've started using Microsoft SkyDrive at work, and it seems to have a pretty solid web client and desktop client as well, and they have an Android client, which I haven't tried. Thinking about these three cloud storage services, are there any major differences between them that would make one more or less attractive than the others? So, Elizabeth, you've dealt with them. What do you think?
I see Google as actually the lightweight in this competition. It's more of the user-friendly things. People are familiar with Google, so it tends to be the go-to one that people know about. And, you know, of course, it's integrated with Gmail and everything else, so sure, you've got all that integration already. However, there are some serious users who need the flexibility of Word and Excel, that Word and Excel offer,
right,
and they should be using things like SkyDrive or using the new Outlook.com, which gives you that 7 gigs of storage.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Dropbox is a great tool as well. I think it depends on what your needs are. So when you have Google Drive for the individual who wants to collaborate easily on documents with others, like we did for this podcast.
Sure. Yeah.
And also special items, you know, that are not required. You know, you don't have to have all this special extra stuff.
You don't have to download anything. It's just there.
It just works.
And then, of course, basic word processing functions are there. Ability to edit docs on the go and that kind of thing. SkyDrive is more for the business user, I see, that you would need something more robust like a word processor on the go that is actually Word or Excel or PowerPoint.
Right.
And, you know, you also have that Outlook.com, like the 7 gigs of storage. I just keep going back to that because it's so awesome. And then, of course, there's Dropbox. And the only one drawback that I don't like about Dropbox desktop client is that it uses so much data. Almost the bandwidth is ridiculous on it. And it just drags down my network so much. So I have to turn it on and off.
What's the biggest benefit of Dropbox then?
I think the biggest benefit is that you can actually upload really large files and share them to other people, and they automatically download.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've used all of them, and they do all have their own benefits and disadvantages. We, of course, kind of favor Google Drive because of the collaboration.
But
that is fantastic.
I use Dropbox on my home machine. It integrates seamlessly, so I love that.
All right, we've got to take another break. When we come back, we got even more of your questions. This is Deemable Tech.
Welcome back to Deemable Tech. I'm Tom Braun, joined, of course, by my co-host, Ray Hollister.
And don't forget our special guest, Elizabeth Pampalone.
The lovely Elizabeth.
See, that's why you're my co-host.
Oh, I'll get you for that one.
All right. We got a question from Chad. He says, I'm thinking about buying Borderlands 2 for my PC.
Sweet.
Usually, I just head over to my local GameStop, but I noticed that the website says it's also available for download on Steam. Steam in the cloud. I don't know anything about Steam. What exactly is Steam? Well, I guess he has the same question. I like having a game box so I know if something goes wrong, I can reinstall the game. But it would be really convenient to download games instead of having to go to the store. If I buy games on Steam, will I be able to re-download them if my hard drive dies or I buy a new computer? You know what he's talking about? I have no idea what Steam is.
I do. I love Steam, actually.
This is all you, then.
I'm a big booster for them. Chad, thanks for the question. Yeah, I'm always happy to talk about Steam because I seriously do use it all the time. Steam is actually the cloud, basically. It's a cloud that is full of games. It's a magical cloud. back when I had free time a long time ago, I was a big PC gamer, and I still occasionally enjoy blowing off Steam with games on my MSI laptop. Thanks to Steam, I haven't darkened the door of a GameStop in years. I'm not kidding. And to answer your question, I have been through half a dozen hard drives and at least three computers, and I still have access to every Steam game I have ever purchased over the last 5 years or whenever they started up with Steam. So,
awesome.
Yeah. So what is Steam? Steam is basically the App Store for PC games. It works very similarly to the App Store or Google Play Market or whatever. You can purchase games, including nowadays, virtually every major PC release. When it started out, it was really like, okay, here's small games. Now it's like, if it's a PC game, it's on Steam. Like,
okay.
You know, AAA, big time release, Call of whatever. Yeah, it's out there. Yeah, and you have to use a credit card, and then you download the game and then and there. And you can always re-download games you've purchased. You don't even have to lose a hard drive, actually. If you just need to clear some space off your machine, you can remove a purchased game from your hard drive and re-download it later.
Oh, that's great.
Steam allows you to build a friends list, which is really nice for the purposes of playing multiplayer games, because you know how those games with strangers tend to go, where you run into crazy people. If you and a friend both have the same multiplayer game on Steam, you can enter the game and then invite the friend to join. You can see when your friends are playing what games.
Oh, great.
You can also jump out of a game of Steam to the Steam client at any time and chat with friends. Hmm. And finally, just because you purchased a game in a box doesn't mean you can't use it on Steam. Steam actually allows you to add games you've purchased elsewhere to it so your friends can see what you're playing. And you can participate in Steam's multiplayer features. So even if you didn't get the game off Steam, you can still use Steam's stuff. It also supports voice chat, even if the game you're playing doesn't.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Huh.
And you can gift games to friends on Steam or even friends who don't have Steam yet. And this is a great way to get something for the nerd in your life who already has everything. Steam was created by Valve, which is the company responsible for Half-Life and the Portal series, in order to distribute Half-Life 2. And since then, it's grown way beyond just Valve games. Virtually every major game released nowadays is, again, available for Steam.
Okay.
And also, I have to boost indie games. Like, I love the cool little indie games.
What's an indie game?
You know, like indie music. It's independent. They're often smaller scale.
So they're not by big game developers like Valve. It'd be smaller guys.
They're often like throwbacks to sort of like your Super Nintendo games or whatever.
Okay.
Go on Steam and search for Humble Indie Bundle, and these are packages of like 5+ games where you can pay what you want, and you get a number of really cool independent games. And if you have a lot of nostalgia for early Nintendo platform games or that pixelated 8-bit feel, you're going to love the indie games on Steam.
Okay.
Oh, and I have to mention the sales. The sales! Every day, Steam has random sales of both indie games and AAA releases. And so remember that shiny $60 game that you were interested in 3 months ago? Steam may have it for 10 or 15 bucks for a couple of days to hook you in. And,
okay.
Yeah. Hmm. And they'll even sell multiplayer games in packs where you can buy 4 copies at once at a discount and distribute them to your friends who hopefully will pay you back. Maybe that's something you could work on, Steam, because I always have to, I mean, I love my friends, but it's like, send me 15 bucks. Come on, guys. And sometimes Steam will even release a game developer's entire back catalog for peanuts.
Really? So you get all the ones that the developers ever made.
Yeah, going back to like 1995 or whatever.
You know, I hate to ask you because I'm not much of a gamer. You said AAA releases. What is that?
Oh, that's just like, you know, big brand name releases. I don't know. An example might be like one of the Mario games.
Oh, okay.
Or on PC.
Well, they don't have it on Steam, but
right. They won't. You know, like Call of Duty, Batman, like a Batman Arkham Asylum, just something that, you know, it's a big, serious release you see TV commercials for.
No, you sound as excited about this as I sound about Apple products.
Yeah, I'm a big Steam believer.
What were you about to say?
I actually am going to go home this evening and look up, see if Nancy Drew's on there, because I used to play those as a kid.
Oh my gosh.
Just keep releasing like 30 of those things.
So. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's worth checking because they have games from way back. They do.
All right. So are you a Steam fanboy? It sounds like you are.
I am a Steam fanboy. I'm a believer. I'm a steamer. Okay, forget I said that.
That's not the best name for it.
No, I'll come up with a better one.
So if you're interested in this, where do you go to find out about this?
I believe it is steampowered.com.
Okay.
And you have to download the client, which just means the program that allows you to interface with the cloud.
And basically, like you were saying, this is like an app store for computer games.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, we're all familiar with those. I mean, if we've used Android or iOS, you know, it's safe. It's easy to use.
Yep.
It's super, you know, you have all your stuff backed up in one place.
Exactly.
Automatically. So that makes it kind of easy. Well, cool. I might check that out as well. Of course, my computer's so old, it'll probably just die just downloading the client.
I just had one more thing. Since it is the 100th year anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, there was a PC game of the Titanic. So I'm going to check that one out too.
I was a big fan of that. I remember that one. I was a Titanic nerd too back in the day. That was a long time ago. Never mind.
Icebergs are awesome.
All right. Well, we got another email from, let's see. Was this from Elizabeth? No. Oh, here's a question. Sorry, I got confused there. The question is, I just deleted a file and realized I needed it back. I opened the recycle bin and it wasn't there. Any ideas? Ooh. Elizabeth, do you know an answer to this?
Oh, well, that's a kind of a difficult question because there's a couple of different scenarios. I mean, was this file on a flash drive or an external drive or a memory card? If so, it's probably gone. Flash drives and thumb drives usually don't use physical memory. They're just electrical charges on a solid state drive. So they're not actually physically there. So if that was the case and it's on a flash drive, an external drive, or a memory card, it is gone. However, if you were using it on a hard drive, there are a lot of ways to recover it because it was physically there and now it's not. So your computer just isn't recognizing it because it has been renamed to a deleted file. And there are certain programs you can get that allow you to recover things like that. One of them is called Restoration from snapfiles.com. And it's a pretty good program. It does, you know, a lot of stuff. So if you want to check that out, you can go to snapfiles.com/get/restoration.
Right. And we'll post a link to that in the show notes as well.
Okay. All right. Let's see. We've got another one from, let's see, that's from Mike. Tom, can you grab that one real quick?
Sure. Mike says, at work, I have to use a Mac and PC. It's a long story. I have some programs that were bought on Mac that don't have PC counterparts, and we have some applications that were built for the company and only work on Windows. And it's really annoying having two keyboards and two mice on my desk. Are there Y cables or something that I can use to share one keyboard and one mouse with two computers, or is there some software I could use to do that? Both computers are on the same network, if that matters. And if there is, would it make either or both of them run slow or interfere with them? Also, is there some way I could use my iPhone or iPad to control either of them? Thanks. Love the show.
Okay. Well, thanks for your question, Mike. The cable you talked about is called a KVM switch, or a keyboard, video, and mouse switch. It does allow you to share a mouse, keyboard, and monitor with two different computers. They can run anywhere from like $20 to $100. There are also some KM switches, which appropriately is for keyboard, mouse, cables that they will allow you to share just a keyboard and a mouse with two computers that have two separate monitors. If you're using the two different computers at the same time, this might be the best option for you, the KM switch. The good side of using a physical cable is that the connection is the fastest, and you'll never have any lag at all. The downside is, of course, you're limited by the length of the cable, and to go back and forth between the two computers, you have to press a button or turn a switch. There are two great programs that do the same thing as a KM switch over your network instead of a cable. There's one called ShareMouse, which works on 32 or 64-bit Windows and on XP, Vista, and 7. No Windows 8 version as of yet, but that's not surprising with Windows 8 still on the horizon.
Yeah.
It also works on Apple's Mac OS, Snow Leopard, Lion, or Mountain Lion, so a wide variety of different operating systems it works on. It is super easy to use. It doesn't require a lot of tech savviness to set up. However, it normally costs $30 per computer.
Ooh.
So another option, and my personal preference, is a program called Synergy. Synergy works on Windows, Mac, and Linux. It's only a tiny bit harder to set up than ShareMouse, but it's free and it's open source. So there's a whole community of people who are constantly working on it to make it better. On both programs, you don't have to press a button to switch computers, and it's just as simple as sliding your mouse off the edge of one screen, and it'll appear on the other screen. Also, both programs support clipboard sharing, which is you can copy text on one computer and paste it on another. So that makes my life a lot easier, because I use multiple computers at work, and it's great. Both of them are relatively small programs, so they don't use up a lot of resources on your computers, and they use hardly any bandwidth on your network to run. There, one potential downside of using these programs is that if your network is bogged down, like if you're, you know, running streaming video or downloading a lot of stuff, you might notice a slight lag in reaction time. Also, neither option support sharing a monitor between the two computers. If you're trying to do that, you'll need a you'll need something like a VNC application or remote desktop. But what I would do is start out by trying Synergy. That'll probably solve your problem the best. And if it doesn't work, then try ShareMouse or try a hardwired KM or KVM switch. And if you need help setting up Synergy, Lifehacker has a great how-to article, and we'll include that in the show notes. Cool. In answer to your second question, there is an iOS app for Synergy, but it's still in beta testing, and you have to be jailbroken on your iPhone or iPad to use it. To control my PC from my iPhone or iPad or Android device, I use a Mobile Mouse Pro. This is a fantastic app. It works on XP or higher, macOS 10.5 or higher, and Ubuntu Linux. Mobile Mouse Pro is in the App Store for $1.99. It's in Google Play for $2.99. And you have to install a small server app on your desktop. But once you do and open the app, your phone or tablet basically turns into a multi-touch trackpad and a remote keyboard and a music and presentation remote. So it's really nice. Fantastic for $1.99. And it's kind of cool. You can also use your phone as a gyroscopic mouse. Okay. Which means you move your mouse with your hand motions, kind of like how a Nintendo Wii works.
And none of your coworkers will think you're weird while you're doing this.
Yeah, not at all. But if you just want to try it out before you buy it, too, there is a free version called Mobile Mouse Lite in the App Store and the Google Play Store as well. So we'll include links to that as well also.
Yeah. All right. We have another question here, and this is one that I have. I mean, it's just one of those terms you hear a lot. And you might not know what it means. Amber writes, "Dear Deemable Tech, what is a permalink? I always see it at the bottom of articles, but I'm unsure what it is or how to use it or if it's in any way relevant to my life. Thanks."
Oh, okay. Well, a permalink is quite simply a permanent link.
Oh, I love it.
It's a little Fu Manchu of the word, squish them together. In the early days of the web, back when Al Gore invented it, all links were permanent back then.
That's the way Al Gore wanted it. That's how he intended it.
Oh, I love political flubs. Not going to get into that. Okay. Anyways, once a website was posted, basically it didn't change that much. Then in 1999, websites like Blogger and LiveJournal started popping up. And websites, as we knew them, were forever changed. Instead of a website not changing very often, websites were changing every single day, sometimes several times a day.
Right.
And folks were sharing links to websites, which was kind of new, too. People were, sharing a lot of stuff.
Go check out my LiveJournal.
Right. And by the time the person would click on the link, the content that they were actually looking for was just impossible to find.
Because those articles, they get buried, right?
Right. They keep going down. Yeah. Yep. So in March of 2000, the founders of Blogger figured out that they could create links to the individual articles of a blog, and the permalink was thus born.
Mm-hmm.
Now people could easily share links to individual stories instead of to the entire website, and they could actually find what they were looking for a lot easier. Now, nowadays, it's kind of an antiquated term. Every link is expected to be a permalink. And as far as how to use it, you would use a permalink if you were trying to share a link to an article in an email or on a social network like Facebook or Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that is really prominent right now is that WordPress uses permalinks a lot. So if you're doing any kind of WordPress individual where you have your own domain and your own hosting for WordPress, then it really actually – it's really helpful to know what they are and to actually research them a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And WordPress being another blogging tool,
exactly.
Basically.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, our website, deemable.com, is built on WordPress. Yep. And if you click on the title, it gives you the permalink. But if you're just on Deemable and you're browsing through and
if you're just on our front page.
Yeah, if you send someone a link to Deemable, they're not necessarily going to find what you're talking about. So that's what you would use them for. And that way, like I was saying, instead of going to the main website like Deemable.com, it'll go to an individual article like, episode 16, we took the lollipop.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, well, let's see. Do we have time for another question?
I think we probably have a little more time. Let's see what we got here. Flip through the files. Oh, we have this one about the Windows desktop shortcuts.
Okay, that's from Kathy. I can read that one.
Sure.
She writes, "I had an icon on my desktop that opened my Yahoo email. It's missing. I don't know what happened to it. Possibly my husband deleted it. How can I get it back?
Crafty husband. I actually hear this a lot, Kathy. The icons on your Windows desktop are almost always quote-unquote shortcuts. A shortcut means that instead of keeping the actual program or file on your desktop where anyone might accidentally delete it, like in your case, maybe your husband, you just have an icon that links to the location of the program or file.
And actually, it's designated by a small arrow in the bottom left-hand corner.
That's right. You look for that little white arrow. You can always tell. So a shortcut is basically an icon plus a location. Now, this location doesn't have to be on your computer. You can make shortcuts that link to websites as well. In your case, obviously, you had a shortcut to the Yahoo Mail website on your desktop. Fortunately, that's very easy to recreate.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first thing we need to do is to find the location of the Yahoo Mail webpage. Open up Internet Explorer and search for...
I love how you pronounce Yahoo. I'm sorry.
Yahoo. Yahoo. I'm sorry. Yahoo. From the South. We're all Yahoos.
What a Yahoo.
Here. What a Yahoo. Open up Internet Explorer and search for Yahoo Mail. You should be able to do this by clicking on the magnifying glass in the top of your browser and typing it in. If your version of Internet Explorer doesn't have this, you can just use a search engine like Google. Now, when I search for Yahoo Mail, the first result I get is, you guessed it, Yahoo Mail.
Surprisingly.
Hopefully it will be for you as well. Click on that link to open up the webpage. Now, here's the important part. Once we're on the Yahoo Mail webpage, we need to get the web address of this page.
Right.
So right-click up in the web address bar and select copy from the menu that pops up. And this is assuming, of course, you're on Windows. Now we need to get back to your desktop. So minimize Internet Explorer and any other windows you may have blocking your view of the desktop. And on the desktop, right-click, and then when the menu pops up, hover your mouse cursor over New. And you'll see another little menu pop out to the right of that one, or maybe to the left. And near the top should be an option that says Shortcut. Click that. Now you'll see a window asking for the location of the item you wanted to create, and you can just paste in the web address that you just copied. So we're almost done. Click Next. Now you just need to give the shortcut a name so you know what it is. Yahoo Mail might be a good name for it. Click Finish, and voila, you should have a new shortcut to Yahoo Mail on your desktop.
Yeah, and a lot of times they'll have actually, you know, where it says you can bookmark it and save it to your desktop.
Yeah,
sometime.
That's true, too. So.
The iPhone actually does that really well with Safari. They'll say you can actually add the square, you know, the app.
Very cool.
Yeah, well, that is all the time that we have for today. Thanks for all your emails. Keep them coming. It's questions@demable.com. And call us. Leave us a voicemail at 904-372-3336. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a good review, like we always say, if you enjoyed it. And if you don't, still go ahead and leave us a good review. We won't tell anybody. Our producer is Sean Birch. I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
I'm Elizabeth Pampalone.
And this is Demable Tech. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Support for Demable Tech is provided by A Small Orange, a refreshingly different approach to web hosting, on the web at asmallorange.com, and by A. Edelson LLC, simple, green, technology consulting, on the web at aedelson.com, and by Jack's Computer Guys, providing desktop and laptop service for all of Northeast Florida, on the web at jackscomputerguys.com.